Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Greetings from the Hill Country of Central Texas. This is Revolution of Military Affairs, and I'm your host, Amos Fox. Today's episode is with Professor Paul Post from the University of Chicago. This is going to be the first of a two-part series with Professor Post. I took this episode, which is about an hour long, and I decided to split it into two, just so it's a bit more digestible for the listener. So, again, this is just one conversation. It's going to be split into two episodes, but I think it's a fascinating discussion with Professor Post, and I hope you enjoy it. All right. Good afternoon, and welcome back to the Revolution of Military Affairs podcast. Today on the podcast, we have Professor Paul Post. He's the associate professor in political science in the political science department at the University of Chicago. And you know, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast, Paul. I first came across your work on social media. I saw people posting and resharing and commenting and probably slandering you to a degree also, just because that's the way that goes on social media, specifically on Twitter, as you've commented on all the things that are going on in the international system today. So, Paul, just thank you for your time today, and I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure being on the program.
So just real quick with the social media thing, I just wanted to ask you about that because I think it's actually a really useful tool. And I think as a professor, it's a smart way to go about engaging A, with the material, but B, with a larger audience outside of the small clique of, you know, political scientists and international relations students that you probably deal with. So how did that come about? And have you gotten positive feedback? I'm sure you've gotten a lot of negative feedback. So I'm just interested on that.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you asked about the social media side of things. And I should add that the vast majority, close to unanimous feedback is positive. And indeed, I've even been recognized by one of our professional associations, the International Studies Association, for my Twitter account, now X, but I'm still calling it so platform formerly known as Twitter.
I'm right there with you. Yeah,
exactly. So I've received just a lot of positive feedback in that regard, also from my university. And so in that sense, that's obviously something that encourages me a lot. And the other thing that encourages me to continue to do this is the fact that it connects me to individuals like yourself and generates these kind of opportunities to reach out to an audience that I wouldn't otherwise have an opportunity to be able to reach out to. And so that's a major reason why I like engaging on social media. Having said that, the main reason I started with social media, I started with Twitter back in 2018, was I was planning to use it as a way to generate new content and, if you will, even live content for my teaching. And specifically thinking about my undergraduates, I teach the large Intro to International Relations course at the University of Chicago. And I thought this could be a good way to generate content for that course in a way that moves beyond the traditional textbook format. Mm-hmm. And so actually what I would do is I made that where my students had to follow. They didn't have to follow me on Twitter, but they had to check out certain things that I would post on my Twitter account. That was actually one of the reasons why I liked using Twitter, was because Twitter was one of the platforms where you did not have to have an account in order to be able to see the content. I could just simply share the links to the students. And, you know, if students wanted to have a Twitter account or and wanted to follow me, they could, but they could also just read the respective threads that I would write on certain IR topics. They could read it themselves. But what I found was that people beyond my class were really finding this useful. And so that started to generate more momentum, if you will, to continue to do this and to produce even more content. And that is really, since then, it's really been notable to me, the number of people who find my content useful. And this ranges from graduate students at other universities, the general public, think tanks, media, as well as my colleagues in international relations, other faculty elsewhere. And so to me, it's really become a rewarding thing to be able to do, to be able to use that platform to help inform international debates about international affairs and share with people to help them understand how someone who uses social science to study international politics actually does that. And so that's for me, has been one of the rewarding things about using social media.
Yeah, I think that it's been really helpful for me too, as a international relations student myself, because it's, you know, you've pointed out different things over the course of, I can't give you a specific example right now, but over the course of all these different threads you've posted, different things that I've been like, I need to go look at that and do some more research in that area. And so I found it very, very useful. So I'm glad that it's gotten the recognition that it deserves, because I think it's a very valuable tool and something more educators probably would be well suited to employ. So shifting off of that, but I guess sort of tied to that, I want to talk a bit about alliances. And so you've got this great book, Arguing About Alliances, The Art of Agreement in Military Pact Negotiations, that you published a few years ago. And I think it's terrific, because there's a lot of debate about what alliances are, what they aren't are, coalitions, proxies, partners, all these different things. And as somebody that's working on a PhD in international relations, but my focus is on proxies and proxy wars, this is a debate I get into all the time too. And one of the... an interesting side story to that, when I was looking into my PhD programs and I was meeting with potential advisors, one of the people that I met with, I was introducing the topic and talking through it, and he said, and he was not an American, and he said, "You Americans are all the same. You want to put everything in nice little boxes, and what you're really talking about isn't a proxy war or proxies. It's alliances and varying degrees of alliances." And then he proceeded to spend like the next 90 minutes browbeating me about how I was incorrect. So needless to say, I did not go that direction with my PhD. I went in that direction with the material, not with that individual nor that school. But I say all that to say, so my takeaway from this, and I'm going to go shorthand real quick so that you can then kind of explain it in a bit more detail. But as I understand it, based off what you've written, it's that alliances are the product of alliance treaties, and that alliance treaties are essentially joint war plans. Did I get that correct? And if so, and if not, would you just elaborate a bit more on that?
No, you absolutely got it correct. And I think there's a couple points that are worth highlighting. But again, in terms of a bumper sticker summary of the book, that was perfect. The main idea behind the book is in some ways to really get at exactly what is going on when states are forming alliances. And a good way to think about why a book about this would be useful is to think about two things. as they stand with respect to the literature on alliances, meaning scholars who have studied alliances, which of course this is one of the oldest strands of international relations literature. So around the time that I'm writing this book, one of the most prominent ideas about alliances is that alliances are a form of signaling. You sign one of these treaties in order to signal to somebody else that, hey, I am defending or I am being defended by this other country, right? And so hence the U.S. having NATO with the various European countries is strictly a signal to first the Soviet Union and now Russia that the U.S. will support them and back them. And so it's very much about the signaling argument. That's the first strand to keep in mind. The other strand to keep in mind is that a lot of people would look at the groupings of states in the world as falling into two camps. One is groups that have these alliances and are sending these signals, and groups that do not have these alliances. So where this book came in was it did two things. First of all, it pointed out that there's actually a third group, which is groups of states that tried to form alliances and didn't get the job done.
Yeah.
And then the other thing it did is in the process of saying, well, why is it that they didn't get the job done? What is it that they couldn't agree on when they came to negotiate? Well, then that's what led me to say, you know what? It's not about, if you actually start looking at the negotiations themselves, they're not talking about signaling. They're not talking about, oh, we got to send a message to the Russians. We got to do this. It turns out that there's lots of ways. That's not to say that's not a goal. Right. That policymakers will have, but there's lots of ways that you can send a message to the Russians that, hey, we're going to guard the Western Europeans, don't invade. You could have unilateral declarations in that respect. You could just simply station troops there, have some sort of agreement that allows that. There's lots of ways you can do it. When it comes to the treaties, what they're talking about during those negotiations are war plans. They're talking about what do we want to accomplish if war breaks out. Now, when I say war plans, and I go into detail about this in the book, it's not necessarily war plans at what we would call the tactical level, right? Yeah. It's not necessarily sitting there saying, okay, we will send 50,000 troops through this gap here and all that. Sometimes it can get to that, and sometimes that's even written to the treaties. But it really starts at the other levels of war play. It starts at the strategic level of like, okay, who are we guarding against? What territory, like what counts? So in the case of NATO, what will count as North Atlantic? Who gets covered by this treaty? That's a big part of it. And then they could go into some of these other details. And indeed, you see treaties where they do. And then there's other ones, like the case of the North Atlantic Treaty, where they just punt on it. And they just put in an article that says, we're going to create some body that will handle all that later on, right? But at the end of the day, what you notice when you start reading through and studying the actual negotiations, what you see is that's what they're talking about during these negotiations. And what's interesting is sometimes that's not even things they're talking about that might even consume a lot of the negotiations don't even show up in the treaty. So hence the North Atlantic Treaty never mentions the Soviet Union. It never mentions Russia, but it's brought up a lot during the actual negotiations. Or like something I point out in the case study of the book, a big thing they kept talking about over and over again, they kept just putting it off because it was such a troublesome issue, was Italy. What do we do about Italy? Do we bring it in? They even referred to it as the Italian problem. And every summary report after each round of negotiations had an appendix that said like status of the Italian problem. The reason why is because Italy, they had just all fought a war against them. And they're like, and they've been demilitarized. So they're like, you know, do we bring them in? Do we not? Do we keep them out? France was really pushing for them to come in. The British and the Americans are like, ah, we're not so sure. But if you read the North Atlantic Treaty, you don't see any of that in it. You know, you do recognize eventually, yeah, Italy is one of the founding members, but you don't get a sense of how during the negotiations, this was like an all-consuming issue. So that overall is what this book is about and kind of elaborates a little bit on the kind of the excellent bumper sticker summary that you provided.
Yeah, that's a very useful breakdown of that, and I think it helps explain it a lot. And I really do think that this book is it does a good job at getting to the heart of that. And that's, you know, as I worked on studying alliances and as it pertains to my own work on proxy war, that's there was a lot of elements that I pulled out of here that I hadn't seen in other places. So with that said, again, I've kind of alluded to it already. How do alliances differ from coalitions and partnerships and proxy principal-proxy relationships?
So this is a huge issue. And by a huge issue, I mean, like, it is, as an academic or someone who studies this, a foreign affairs analyst, you're like, oh my gosh, can we make sure we're using our terminology correctly here, right? Because you'll see, and I think a good way to approach this question is the term allies, right? We hear this phrase used all the time. And in fact, I'm involved in a co-author project right now that we're working on, where we're trying to unpack, like, exactly what is meant and what do people think when they're using the word allies. And the reason why is because, and I think this ties very nicely to your work, is you will hear members of Congress refer to allies as a whole host of different actors. They'll call them allies, right? So, for example, going back to when Donald Trump made the decision to essentially, quote, abandon the Kurds in Syria, you had Lindsey Graham saying he is abandoning our Kurdish allies, right? You also see similar language used to refer to Ukraine, you know, our Ukrainian allies, right?
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
But of course, we also use that language to refer to NATO members. And what's really interesting is, in the case of, if you go back to the Kurds in Syria, we did that in deference to an actual treaty ally, which is, of course, Turkey. Right? So, So you can see right away, we're using the word ally to refer to a bunch of different actors with whom we have different relationships. Some of them are codified in actual ratified treaty. That's usually what we refer to as an actual alliance. That is an ally in the form of an alliance. That is NATO, for example, most prominent example. But then we also have countries with whom we have, like, these military affairs partnerships, might even have memorandums with them. That would be more in the line with Ukraine. We're not a treaty ally. They're not a member of NATO, but we get lots of support. We have understandings with them. We've signed agreements that have, where we've backstop security for them, right? This is, you know, very prominent in that sense. So you can think about, you know, whether it's the Budapest Memorandum or the Bucharest Memorandum. Both of these are examples of where the U.S. or NATO countries have essentially made some commitments, security commitments towards them, but not in the form of an actual treaty. And then you have more of these understandings that may not be written down, but this would be what the U.S. typically has with a variety of proxy groups that we would be supporting, or non-state groups where we might have a relationship with them, but it's not a codified treaty. We might be working with them. So this would be, you know, the Kurds in Syria. This would be the Northern Alliance back with the initial invasion of Afghanistan, where we have this understanding. We're working with them. They're partners, but they're not at the level of a treaty ally. And so as a result, there's a different, you know, there's different dynamics involved in terms of what could it mean for your reputation? What are you trying to achieve out of it? How long term do you see this relationship as lasting? Yeah. Obviously, if you're signing a treaty, you probably have more expectations. You're even trying to work out more long term what could be happening. If it's just a verbal understanding, then that would naturally imply this is short term, just marriage of convenience. We're working together to get something accomplished. And a lot of times that's also what happens, not just with non-state actors, but with states when you see coalitions formed, right? If we think about the coalition that was created back in 1990, 91 to move Iraq out of Kuwait, That was a coalition. Short term, the U.S. went around, James Baker doing a lot of shuttle diplomacy to try to pull countries on board with that. But it was just for a very distinct purpose, one time thing. And yes, some of the countries in that coalition were treaty allies. Some of them were not. But the point is it's just this one mission. We need this help. Let's have this understanding. We're not going to write anything down, but let's go ahead and make this happen. And that's where a coalition can come in. So, yeah, I think it's useful to make distinctions between these different concepts and these different types of relationships, even though if you go to DC, you're going to hear the word ally used to describe all of these relationships.
Yeah, it seems like it's almost used in a hyperbolic sense to elicit emotion more so than it is to actually define the relationship itself. The comment on the Kurds, I love that you brought that up because I was working shortly around that time, shortly before actually the time that you mentioned. I was in Iraq. I worked at the coalition headquarters there in Baghdad, fighting the fight against ISIS and the tail end of the Battle of Mosul, and then through the period that when Prime Minister Abadi declared that ISIS had been defeated, and then we started negotiating a drawdown. And so during that time, that was when the Kurds were attacked by Turkey. Right, the Operation Olive Branch was launched, and they came into Irpin and Manbij and all those areas in that northern Syrian corridor there, and It was really interesting to see that dynamic unfold because, you know, a lot of what you said was the words that were used didn't match the relationship that existed. And that, I think, is part of the problem, too. We're so uncomfortable, we being Western states in many regards, are so uncomfortable calling something what it is, right? That's a proxy. You know, it's not a bad word. I know that there's a lot of negative connotation associated with it, but let's just call it what it is because then we can understand better what we're dealing with, you know, and like that situation I thought was very interesting in my own research. I've cited it several times because what you had, you know, there was also some interesting dynamics too, where you had that going on, but then you had coalition alliance members in the headquarters that then had to be excused from certain conversations that pertain to that problem because of what was going on. And I'm being vague on purpose, but it's not hard to figure out who I'm referring to here.
Right.
And so anyway, as part of that too, though, you had, the Kurds. So we had this relationship with the Kurds there in Syria fighting ISIS out in the eastern deserts. And, you know, when Turkey attacks into Syria, attacks into that Kurdistan region there, the Kurds just kind of wave goodbye. And they go north to protect their people. And we were left, there was many questions, you know, at higher levels of command, like what is going on here? And it goes back to that thing, the formality of the agreement, but it's also like that divergent interests come into play, right? And their strategic interests were no longer a marriage of convenience with our own, you know, like, hey, let's eliminate ISIS out here in this Kurdish area. Now we have a somewhat existential threat from a true military force coming in from the north. We're going to pause this relationship. And so you saw several operational pauses in the war fighting against ISIS out there in eastern Syria during that time. And I thought that it was fascinating to be in the headquarters and to see everybody just kind of like, well, what's going on? They didn't understand it because they're like, they're our ally. I'm like, they're not our ally. You know, they're a proxy in a fight against a common enemy.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, what that highlights is this is exactly why, on the flip side, it's important to have a relationship like a NATO relationship, right? Mm-hmm. Because then it's like, okay, we have in Brussels or just outside of Brussels, we're going to meet and we're going to talk about these issues. And we have, you know, commanders there, we have representatives there all the time, and we can hash out if there's a problem, someone feels like they need to shift resources another place, we're going to coordinate on that. And the reason why is because we have this infrastructure in place, we have this long-term relationship. And that kind of infrastructure, of course, wasn't there when it comes to deal with the Kurds, but it's because it's a completely different type of relationship, right? And so I think that this is so critical for this. I think your example is a great one for kind of highlighting, again, why these distinctions aren't just a matter of words. They actually are meaningful in terms of thinking about what you can expect out of the relationship.
Yeah, I completely agree. And that's one of the big findings that I've had with my work on proxies is I bucket it. Basically, there's five types of proxy relationship. There's a couple different things that factor into that. And then within those, each one of those relationships, there's a different type of expectation on the duration and level of risk that that proxy will assume with you. And so anyway, moving on from that, since we're talking about weird relationships, you've commented a lot about the Russo-Ukrainian war. So I want to ask you a couple of questions about that as it relates to this topic here that we're discussing with alliances. So how would you categorize the U.S.-Ukraine relationship? I know you kind of you touched on it briefly when you were talking before, but could you explain it in a bit more detail?
So on the one hand, some people have obviously referred to this as a proxy relationship, right? They even referred to the war as a proxy war, that this is really a NATO-Russia war, but it's being fought, the United States and really the United States is what people are referring to here, but the U.S. and NATO are fighting Russia, but through Ukraine. This has even led to the comments being made that the U.S. is willing to fight to the last Ukrainian, you know, these kind of comments that have been made and people have been saying that type. So that's one view that's out there about this relationship, right? It's a proxy relationship. On the other hand, there's the view, I think there is some nuggets and elements of that that are accurate. And you can indeed see even the rhetoric, if you look at some of the U.S. senators that have gone and met with Zelensky, and then they'll come back and say, this is an investment, right? You know, they're fighting, and look at this. The money we're spending and giving to Ukraine is allowing us to weaken an enemy, and this is great. So those are the kind of comments that feed into the view of, oh, this is just a proxy relationship. But I do think the relationship is deeper than that. It's obviously not at the level of a NATO relationship, though obviously this is something that Ukraine wants. And indeed, I think this is something that there are officials in the U.S. that would eventually like to see that, though they recognize that is not going to happen under current circumstances. But I do think the relationship is more than just simply, hey, this is a convenient short-term proxy that we can use to fight Russia. It's deeper than that. And the reason why is because of the longstanding relationship that the European countries have had vis-a-vis Ukraine, and then in turn that the U.S. has developed with Ukraine. You know, I think a lot of people miss sight, and it's kind of funny, like they shouldn't, but a lot of people miss sight of the fact that the U.S. has been supporting Ukraine since, you know, 2014 when the Crimean Peninsula was taken. But even going back further to where in 2008, the U.S. and NATO countries are making a promise that eventually Georgia and Ukraine will become NATO members. And so the relationship goes back much further than that. And indeed, some people even forget that the first impeachment of President Trump was over aid to Ukraine. You know, that it's like this is a relationship that well predates 2022. So I think that the relationship is deeper than just a simple proxy relationship, convenient, hey, we can, you know, bleed Russia dry by arming Ukraine. But it's obviously not at the level of a U.S. alliance vis-a-vis, say, NATO or, you know, with Japan, Philippines, and sort of maybe even, you know, another state that has kind of an ambiguous relationship with Taiwan, right? Where the U.S. has kind of a treaty in place, one that President Biden has reaffirmed many times, but obviously we have this kind of ambiguous relationship with Taiwan, or at least we maintain an ambiguous status of what exactly Taiwan is. So I think that Ukraine very much fits in the middle. It's not fair to label this as just a simple proxy war and that we're using them for this reason, but it's also clear that they're not at this level as, say, our NATO allies and so on and so forth.
I tend towards the side, but again, it goes back to how I've classified proxies and whatnot in my work. I classify it as a proxy relationship and a proxy strategy within a larger war, but I also don't view it as just a flip of the coin. I don't think that things are as simple, and I think that that's what you're alluding to, too. Things are not as simple as a binary this or that. I also think, you know, when you talk about the it being greater than a proxy relationship, one of the things I think that does help legitimize that too, from a military standpoint, is the establishment. Initially, it was called Task Force Dragon, which was a core level TAC, a forward command post that was there to help do things, I guess, you know, share intelligence and do other stuff. And it was under the command of one of the deputy commanding generals of 18th Airborne Corps, one star. But as we've formalized our relationship with Ukraine as that's gone on, I think it was, I forget the exact date, I think it was about a year ago, maybe a little further back, we stood up, it's called SAGU, the Security Assistance Group Ukraine, and that's a more formal headquarters now, a three-star level command, where a three-star general is supervising and overseeing the security assistance that the U.S. is providing to Ukraine. And so, you know, that I think also pushes it further into that, you know, it's a soft alliance, if you will,
yeah.
Or something, you know, and there's, I'm sure there's all sorts of paper signs somewhere that actually formally lay that out.
Yeah, it's not as a key word we could use here is institutionalized. It's definitely not as institutionalized as a NATO relationship. You know, there's no big gleaming building that we all go to talk about, you know, the U.S. or NATO-Ukrainian relationship. But at the same time, it is much more institutionalized than what you were referring to earlier with the relationship vis-a-vis the Kurds, right? You know, there is this, you know, established relationships, sharing, coordination, training that's going on, memorandums of understanding that have been signed to be able to help with the arming and so forth. There's a lot more involved than what would just be simply a marriage of convenience, short-term relationship, but again, not at the level of the U.S.'s main treaty allies.
That concludes part one of the two-part episode with Professor Paul Post from the University of Chicago. We'll conclude this episode in a week with a break in between this episode and the second with Professor Post, as we have another Hypergiant episode that splits these two. Thank you for listening to Revolution of Military Affairs.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.